Shalom and welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, bringing you these podcasts, which hope to explore some of the issues and events that are impacting ourselves, our families, and the Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging. And we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on the Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging. And if you wish to leave a message on the homepage, JewishSacredAging.com, you can. There's a voicemail message icon that you can click on and leave us a voicemail message on the website. So we're trying to cover all bases. And speaking of covering all bases, this will be the third installment in a three-part little mini-series that we've been running on the workings of Jewish family service around the country, with a specific focus because they're around the corner with the work of Jewish family service, Jewish family and children's service here in southern New Jersey. And to that extent, it is an honor to welcome to the microphone Rebecca Rosenau, the Associate Director of Senior Services for the Jewish Family and Children's Services here in southern New Jersey. Welcome, Rebecca. Rebecca, how you doing?
Fine. Thank you, Rabbi Address, for having me here today.
It's good to see you again. You're running around busy as usual, doing great stuff. We want to talk a little bit about, that's a misnomer. We want to talk a lot about what is in the Jewish Sacred Aging work that I do around North America in congregations, probably in the last several years, still the number one issue that comes up all the time when I visit congregations or organizations, and that has to do with caregiving, the art of caregiving, the explosion of caregiving. So I guess let's start out with the basic stuff. You're the Associate Director of Senior Services. How are you involved with this phenomenon of caregiving?
I've been involved at JFCS in the realm of caregiving with respect to individual supports as well as caregiver and related support groups for now close to 13 years. Those supports, again, they vary from individual supports in the realm of individual counseling and insurance-based service, case management supports, and various types of support groups, whether they are specific for caregivers with specific diagnoses, dementia and Alzheimer's related, Parkinson's, other chronic or terminal conditions, oftentimes liaisoning with hospice and other community supports that exist, as well as some of the more, I would say, social and community-based supports, anything from our Cafe Connection, a memory cafe for care recipients and care partners to come together to sort of leave the diagnosis at the door and receive supports, but be in a familiar setting where others in the room understand what it's like to be in their shoes, but not necessarily to talk about the disease process or what those individuals are facing.
This memory cafe, we've had a couple of months ago, we had Wendy Campbell on, who is the retiring a president of the Delaware Valley Alzheimer's Association. Another colleague of ours, Simcha Raphael, who also is involved, and David Levin with these types of cafes, which seem to death cafes, memory cafes. For people who aren't familiar with this, what is a memory cafe?
So a memory cafe is for anybody with age-related memory changes, not necessarily with a disease or diagnosis specific, although they may, to come for social programming, typically art and music involved, to help people with regards to stimulation, socialization, to participate in an activity with a loved one. That loved one could be a family member, a child, a spouse, or a paid caregiver or friend, where there is no discussion about the diagnosis or what medical ailment somebody is facing, unlike there may be in a support group. This is shown to increase people's well-being, especially from an emotional or mental state. And again, it's at this point, it takes place once a month. It is the first Thursday of the month from 10 until 12 at the CATS JCC. It is a program spearheaded by Jewish Family and Children's Service in conjunction with Jewish Senior Housing and Healthcare Services, as well as the Jewish Community Center, where there is no cost to participants. We have funders who help with the underwriting as well as grants, and we do have community partners who will sponsor each program in order to make it successful and take place without any financial cost to the participants.
Are there other Jewish Family and Children's Services around North America who are doing this?
As far as we know, there are not. There are other, Really?
Wow.
There's expressed interest, and most recently there has been communication between other Cherry Hill and Camden County organizations, including the Cherry Hill Library, which now holds a memory cafe, as well as Arden Court, an assisted living specific for Alzheimer's and dementia care. The benefit is that participants can partake in all of these since they are offered at different days and different times.
So the support groups, I know that Jewish Family and Children's Services around the country, and I know your agency has an entire menu of these support groups. How important are they, and how difficult is it for people to come forward and say, I can benefit from, because it's a lot of clergy who've dealt with family, you know, they'll say, why don't you try this? Well, I'm not a little uncomfortable about going in with strangers and opening up my own vulnerabilities. How do you, as a director of these programs, how do you deal with that?
So support groups are certainly not for everybody. Many people come to our agency and receive some kind of individual support before they might segue to a group. But for others, most of whom, once they have attended a group, they really speak so positively about it. And it's something that we as professionals try to encourage individuals to get into the right group, namely for issues such as anticipatory grief. It's something that we don't necessarily think about and many people don't realize exists until they hear about it and can attribute their own symptoms or emotions as experiencing anticipatory grief. Unlike grief after the loss of a loved one, anticipatory grief is oftentimes not addressed, not recognized, and not necessarily sought in terms of options that might exist to support them. So really being in a room with others who understand and seeking those supports is something that until they're there, they don't realize.
Yeah, I'm having walked this walk myself. I remember dealing with my mom who passed away because of dementia. And speaking to somebody afterwards and saying, how come I'm not feeling the same thing that I was feeling with my dad? And he said, because you started the mourning process, you know, 8 months ago. And that's when he introduced me to this concept of anticipatory grief. People still have difficulty with this, don't they?
They do.
Yeah. It's a phenomenon. And I was just having a conversation with somebody recently who lost a spouse, and we got into this conversation about, you know, the stages, and basically saying you can read all those books and you can go to Barnes and Noble and read all the books you want on caregiving. And they're very, very lovely and they're nice. But the fact of the matter is my experience as a clergy person, and I'm going to ask you as the director of this and a social worker, grief and mourning is extremely personal, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It depends a lot on the variation of caregiving with respect to how somebody might experience grief, what the stages of grief they may experience. Not all stages are the same. Not all experience them in the same order. Many people question what is the difference between grief after death and grief with respect to caregiving. Some people will recognize grief, others won't. Some will say some of the key components of grief with respect to caregiving are isolation, denial, over-involvement, a lot of times putting their everything into caregiving and avoiding every other form of contact, anger, sadness, and at times even acceptance and relief can be seen or understood as a form of grief.
When you sit down with somebody who's entering the cycle, the caregiving tunnel, as I call it sometimes, or actually I use the term roller coaster because it is a roller coaster of emotions. And they're sitting across from you and say, yeah, we just got this. I'm going to have to deal with this. I'm rearranging. What are two of the three things that you tell a person who's about or a family that's about to enter this life stage?
So not only is it a roller coaster, but oftentimes I say caregiving is a continual experiment in creative living. What works today may not work tomorrow.
That's very well said. I like that. I may steal that, but that's okay.
I'll lend it. That's fine.
It's okay.
So what works today may not work tomorrow. I think one of the biggest components and oftentimes not discussed until almost crisis is the financial strain of caregiving. It is never too early to plan, to prepare. One of the biggest challenges is, of course, preparing for what is called the well spouse, as well as the care recipient when they are at two different levels of care, and at times either can no longer reside in the same home or need to plan for not just the now, but for the future. The other piece is, of course, the emotional supports that are essential, not just for the caregiver, but oftentimes the care recipient, if they are aware of their diagnosis and what's going on.
We spend a lot of time now in talking about advanced care planning, end of life, the conversation project. We've had people on the podcast, living wills, advanced directives, etc., preparing for the end of life wishes. But you alluded to the fact, Rebecca, making plans. Do you help people make a care plan? Do people come to you in a relative stage of health and say, look, we know what this may happen, or we're beginning to see changes. We need to sit down with you and make a care plan. Which sibling is going to be responsible for this, not only financially, but logistically, when the primary caregiver gets starting to get burned out, who's going to come in? And do you develop a care plan for a family?
So from the time that we first meet a client, we will do typically an in-home assessment. From that time forward, we do care plans, which are updated quarterly, if not more often, based upon time of need. Many of our involvement does sort of go in line with mediation, in a sense. We are sort of the neutral parties, which will help family members to navigate not just the maze of caregiving, but how do I change what my wishes are, or to implement my wishes with respect to all the different moving parts of various children and perhaps deferring opinions when it comes to this process.
And in the caregiving challenge or life stage, and it is, I really do refer to it as a new life stage, because as you know from your work, it can last not only years, but in some cases, decades. How do you begin to deal, and so I'm sure you have, with letting go of certain stages in that caregiving cycle and saying to someone, it's time for you to make a transition. You can no longer care. I mean, in the Jewish, in the texts that I teach, there's actually texts that support and say, it's Maimonides' text from the 12th century, if you get to this stage, the higher value is you need to cede care to a third party. How do you begin to manage that? Because there's all kinds of psycho-spiritual issues and psychodynamics of saying, you know, I promised Dad I would never do that. I never put him into one of those places, but I just can't do this anymore. How do you begin to manage that?
I think part of it is trying to help the person, the caregiver, recognize to him or herself that they're compromising their own well-being, that they're no longer not only making their medical appointments, but keeping their medical appointments. So from the time that we meet somebody and throughout our assistance with them, we do caregiver assessments and ensure that they are taking care of themselves as best as is possible. A lot of times it's starting off slow. Most people are not going to go from having no assistance at home to having a 24-hour caregiver, or moving from home to assisted living without having some hourly help in between. Some people will start with some homemaker services in their home just to take off the burden of some meal prep or changing of linens and other pieces of maintaining not just the home, but giving some respite to the caregiver in order to start that process. Once the caregiver can see that there's benefit to having supports, oftentimes they will, whether it's willingly or reluctantly, accept more assistance.
So that leads to the question, obviously, because this is so such an intense, and there's usually, as you know, a designated caregiver, and a lot of this caregiving is done alone. How do you begin to work with the family to counteract this phenomenon of what is called caregiver burnout?
I think it's case by case. There's so much variation with respect to this that it's not a cookie cutter kind of response, unfortunately.
So many clergy people, rabbis, priests, ministers, imams, people who deal with their, will actually see the impact of this long-term caregiving on an entire family system. It's another thing. People think, oh, it's just the caregiver and their spouse or their daughter or their son. But we've, as you know, it's a family systems issue. And I'm interested to have you kind of like walk us through a little bit about how you begin to, as I'm sure you've dealt with this, in a family systems deal with the impact of caregiving, especially that it takes a long, I know in religious, sometimes you'd have the kid in fourth grade in religious school who is totally tuned out because mom and dad are so busy with grandpa or grandmom that they don't pay any attention to him anymore. But that's all part of this systemic approach, isn't it?
Sure is. There's certainly a lot of deficits that exist when a caregiver is caring for more than one loved one at a time, oftentimes parent and spouse or parent and child. I've run many support groups where somebody is in my group because they are caring for more than one loved one at a time.
Wow.
And they're truly suffering, but they are not alone.
No. And I also saw a statistic I'm interested in your response that I think it was an AARP survey last year that somewhere around 20-some percent of people who are active caregivers are now millennial generation, people between 18 and 32, which really surprised me. And another statistic that said that in recent years, because of the shift in family dynamics, there are more men who are becoming involved with more full-time involvement with caregiving. So has that been your experience here?
So I've certainly experienced more and more men who are full-time caregivers in comparison to many years ago, more so than the millennial piece. I think the millennials are caregivers, but for whatever reason, they are not presenting themselves to social service agencies for assistance.
Oh, okay.
They may be going right to the home care agency, or they may be taking on more themselves than, let's say, somebody over 60 who might be willing or in need of more additional hands-on supports.
One of the things that came up in the previous two conversations with your colleagues, with Marla and Susie Abrams, with Marla Myers and Susie Abrams, is this whole real challenge of isolation, of individuals who are just isolated and alone and without any type of social network or social support network. That I would imagine that when an agency seeks these people out and tries to connect with them, that really presents a huge challenge. I mean, somebody with no family, with no support system, no children, whatever, how do you deal with that?
It depends on why they are coming to us, but programs that have recently been created, such as Cafe Connection, has been created in part because of what you're just describing now. For those who are willing to accept in-home supports, it does reduce their social isolation. It provides them support, not necessarily one-on-one support from an emotional standpoint for the caregiver, but respite, enabling them to then get out and be able to partake in the things that they once enjoyed. Again, it depends on what individuals are willing to accept. So it's really case by case. Some of the programs we've offered in the community have been in support group fashion where respite is provided, such as at one of our monthly support groups for individuals with Alzheimer's or dementia, where the caregiver can come and the care recipient can attend a social program for that 1 hour support group. So therefore, both are then partaking in socialization and receiving support rather than being isolated at home, not having somebody to stay with the loved one to be able to get the supports. So we've been trying to find loopholes as well as ways to enable somebody to get what they need without the barriers that obviously exist.
Yeah, I would imagine that there are still people who, well, I don't imagine, I know that there's still people who fall through the cracks, who just don't even know who to call, how to pick up the phone and call or have somebody intervene for them and be their advocate. I know we talked about this with Susie Abrams on last week's podcast about the Patient Partners Program. We're talking with Rebecca Rosen now, the Associate Director of Senior Services for the Jewish Family and Children's Service here in Southern New Jersey, about ways in which an agency like JFCS around here and around the country can be helpful, supportive, and involved with this phenomenon of this new life stage called caregiving. We talked a little bit about isolation. There's been one of the challenges that I keep reading about in the literature is the fact that as baby boomers continue to age out, and we and our generation now begins to enter the fact that we eventually will also need care. And given the statistics from the Alzheimer's Association about the anticipated growth in dementia Alzheimer's cases in the next couple of decades, we keep reading that they're just not going to be enough qualified caregivers, geriatricians to take care of us. I mean, you deal with this 24 hours a day, 7 days. This is your life involvement in these programs. Taking a step back, you know, and somebody who runs these programs, how do you begin? How can we as a society begin to deal with the fact that there is going to be, if these reports are true, and they seem to be, a real shortage of qualified people to take care of us?
So I think planning ahead whenever possible, knowing what resources exist, who to turn to, can only help. But as you're insinuating, and as we know, it's expected that the services and the needs are only going to increase, with approximately 10,000 people per day turning age 65.
Right.
Some call this the silver tsunami. Others call it wonderful or an opportunity. I think we all have to be proactive and get our names out there to work towards fighting for equal pay with respect to the paid caregivers, which of course is one of the biggest underpaid jobs there.
No. There's a wonderful book that came out about 2 years, I think, called The Age of Dignity by a woman, a MacArthur scholar named Ajen Poo, P-O-O is her last name. And the thesis of the book is exactly what you're talking about. It says there are not going to be enough people. The home healthcare worker is so underpaid and overworked. I mean, one of her desires is to really unionize this and raise the level of qualifications. And I know there are some home healthcare agencies that do require training, extensive training, but not all. And so this seems to be a morass, a labyrinth that for the layperson coming into your office and saying, my God, I have to face this now. What do I do? I'm sure it's just totally overwhelming. Who to call, when to call, how much does it cost? Does my insurance pay for it? I don't have insurance. I thought I had insurance. How do you, do you in your work help navigate this maze, just the economics of it?
We always point people to use a diagnosis to their advantage. Nobody wants a diagnosis, regardless of what that is. But if you have a diagnosis, if it's Alzheimer's, if it's Parkinson's, if it's cancer, it's important to know what resources exist to help you not only pay for care, but what grants and programs exist to help you cope with that. For example, whether it's the Alzheimer's Association with respect to paying for an adult medical or social daycare program, that can make all the difference between being able to attend or not. The Alzheimer's Association has various grants, as do some of the adult daycare centers, but if you don't know to ask for them, they're not necessarily offered. The American Cancer Society, again, paying for ongoing supports, even so much as transportation to get chemotherapy or radiation, it is astronomical. Knowing where to turn is essential. And again, if you have a diagnosis, if it's paying for medications for your diabetes, or knowing that you can get diabetic shoes once a year paid for by your insurance to help with your ailments, it's something people don't know unless they are told or see it somewhere.
So you and other JFCSs will help navigate this maze.
We will. That is part of what we do.
Do you because this comes up all the time now, do you help people navigate the Medicaid, have qualifying somebody for Medicaid?
If it's a client we are already working with, we will help them in so much that we know of their circumstances financially and logistically, as well as what their physical needs are when they're applying for Medicaid, whether it's in-home Medicaid or assisted living or nursing home Medicaid. If somebody is contacting us for the first time in need of assistance and applying for Medicaid, we will be the first ones to tell them it wouldn't be to their benefit to come to a social service agency where it is not our expertise. We oftentimes and always refer to elder law attorneys, financial planners, or to the Medicaid office itself for guidance and information. We will provide some assistance with where to go, who to turn to, what to ask, but not with actually filling out the application.
There seems to be recently, and on the federal level, and also on some of the state level, the attempt to pass legislation to give tax credits, support for family caregiver, family leave, family caregivers. How involved is your agency or the national Jewish Family and Children's Service Agency, you know, the national coordinating body, in lobbying for, like, I know AARP is very involved with it. How involved are you with the legislative aspect of this?
We try to be aware of what's going on, but we are not as involved as we would like to be. In part, we do not have a designated staff person to do that on a full-time or even part-time basis, although we have gone to Washington, D.C., as well as Trenton, to advocate over the years with respect to caregiver payment and assistance that's needed, as you're talking about. With respect to reimbursement for care from a caregiver who's unpaid, residing with a family member, let's say, we have found that they are only eligible for assistance if they are not working outside of the home and if there are not other paid caregivers in place. So there are a lot of areas of gray which make it very difficult and challenging, almost impossible, even for those who do qualify.
What's the name of the, because it escapes me, the national coordinating body for Jewish Family and Children's Services?
They are known as the Association of Jewish Family and Children's Service Agencies. However, recently, I believe that they've also changed names and maybe under another acronym.
Yeah, that's, of course, it's a Jewish organization. Let's change the name and drive everybody crazy. It's part of the game. Are they involved legislatively? Do you know? I mean, you may not know. I mean, the thought occurred to me is what national organization, it would seem to be in their best interest to be involved with this, or at least knowledgeable of it.
They are involved, but I don't know to what frequency.
What do you see as the number one stressor for caregivers? Is it time? Is it money? Is it juggling family? What would you say is the number one?
I think it's money. I think really? Finances, yes. Because for those who don't have financial strains or as much as some others, they're able to implement care. They're able to put in assistance, whether it's a few hours a day or 24/7 care. They're able to choose an assisted living or continuing care retirement community of their choice. If they are faced with having to make a choice as to living at home versus moving, if they have time, they can implement if they have finances, they can implement services. If they don't, having time won't solve their problems either.
Yeah, I always maintain when we go out and talk about this that for most of the people in the group, we're all one medical crisis away from real financial hardship. I'm sure you deal with this every single day. You know, for somebody who may be listening who's walking this walk right now and who's financially, I mean, we know that it costs a lot of money to place somebody in an assisted living facility, to bring in home health care workers 5 or 6 hours a day, even 3 days a week. The money adds up and insurance does not, even long-term care insurance doesn't even necessarily deal with it. How do you begin to work with that individual and family to ease that burden or to lift them up and to begin to have them be able to walk this walk without just being so totally crushed under the burden of economics?
So I think number one, we always want to see what people have to work in their benefit, what insurance coverage they do have. Insurance coverage could be for individual counseling. Many people don't know that they have mental health benefits under their insurance plan, that through Medicare and a secondary insurance, their counseling services could be covered in full or in part. Additionally, some know that they have long-term care insurance, but they don't know what it covers, or they're saving it for the future, for that, let's say, rainy day, or if things should get worse. But the worst may be now. They may be putting it off and therefore never activating their long-term care insurance if they don't know when and how to activate it. Some policies cover a lot more than people realize. In addition, again, connecting people with grants, connecting people with programs and services that exist, whether it's at no cost to them or at minimal cost, can make a difference, especially when someone's feeling overwhelmed, not knowing what questions to ask. They don't necessarily have an advocate or somebody who's navigating this maze for them.
You alluded to this just a minute ago. I want to ask you this because it keeps coming up over and over again in a lot of these conversations. What's the mental health component of being a caregiver?
So first, caregivers are at least twice as likely as non-caregivers to report physical and mental health complications. Oftentimes, they face death before the person they're caring for, either out of neglect or not recognizing what symptoms they're facing. They also face increased risk of depression, anxiety disorders, diminished immune systems, greater incidence of hospitalization. The list is endless, and it's something that without implementing not just emotional support, but physical support, by implementing care, by involving other family members when at all possible, caregivers are and will continue to feel like they're drowning without recognizing and putting the supports in place.
I always tell a family when they begin this process that is, I said, I'm going to say something that may sound very silly to you, but make sure you get rest and make sure you take some time off and make sure you eat. Because I'm sure you've seen two people who get so involved in the guilt that they really do neglect. That's why this caregiver burnout is so, it's such a powerful thing. And I think until you walk the walk, until you actually have to do this, you really don't understand the implications. And it's a slow process, isn't it? I mean, you just don't, you sort of like, it takes a long time for your body to just begin to wear down. And a lot of times, I'm sure you've seen this because every clergy person who deals with this in their congregation has seen people who all of a sudden they physically change. They look different. And it's all because of this stress.
It is. And when you're in the midst of it, you don't realize what you're feeling, what you're doing. I'd like to share just a few lines from a former caregiver client of mine who wrote me a letter after her both mother and husband died to share with the rest of the caregiver support group she was a part of. She said, "At times, one gets involved with a necessary to-do and do and do list. You forget about why you are caregiving. The most important thing is to keep in front of you. There are moments of joy that only you, on a very personal and private level, can experience. They are usually unexpected, a smile, a plan that actually works, an inner feeling of satisfaction that outsiders do not know or will never share. When it is over, and it will be over, that quiet pause is filled with all those many shared sparks that you may have saved a life. And in doing so, you have multiplied the meaning of your own."
Which is a great segue into this thing I wanted to end with. And that is, it has also been in my experience, and I, just from what you've read, your experience too, that if a caregiver is able to step back and understand the dynamics of what is taking place, these can be opportunities for unbelievable personal growth and transformation. On a familial, but more personal and spiritual, and I use that term advisedly, because as I'm sure you talk about, when you reverse roles, when you actually, you know, have to, in essence, parent your own parent in many ways, there are these quiet moments where real deep meaning that may never have taken place in years in the parent-child relationship now open themselves up. And I've seen it. I'm sure you've said, and I'd like to have you comment on it, that real sense of personal growth and interaction and change and transformation takes place between these two individuals. Could you just comment? Have you seen that?
I've certainly seen it. So many people talk about the unexpected joys of caregiving, that the caregiving itself is much more rewarding than anything they could have imagined. Many don't necessarily phrase it as such until, sadly, the caregiving journey is over, at which time they say they wish they could just have one more moment to hold their hand, one more assistance with providing bathing or dressing assistance to their loved one, one more time going to the adult daycare. There are, of course, many ups and downs back to that roller coaster of this maze of caregiving. But for those that don't have the experience, sadly, those who face a terminal condition and don't have the chance to provide caregiving, some will question, is it better to have that long goodbye, that time with their loved one to provide the care, or is it better to live life to the fullest and die in one sleep and not have those lingering days? There's no easy answer, but for those after the fact, after the caregiving is ended, they step back and would not want to replace it in any other way.
Last question before we end this podcast. Easy question. This is the easy question. Okay. You spend most of your time dealing with families and individuals, caregiving, in such a variety of different circumstances. Do you have an opinion, personal? I'm not asking you to reflect the agency because I want, who knows. But you personally, do you have an opinion on the pending legislation in New Jersey on medical aid in dying?
I think if somebody's of sound mind and they are living in pain, physical pain, emotional pain, there should certainly be options out there to assist them. But there's a fine line because many people are not necessarily making their own decisions. They have a spouse, a parent, a child, a friend designated as their healthcare power of attorney, and it can become a slippery slope as to when their viewpoint or wishes are being respected and not the person, him or herself, who's going through that terminal condition. It's very tough.
It is very tough. That's why I said this is the easy question. Yeah, it is very tough, but thank you. Rebecca Rosenau, the Associate Director of Senior Services for Jewish Family and Children's Services here in Southern New Jersey. Thank you, Rebecca. These three conversations with you and Susie Abrams and Marla Myers have been very, very helpful. And I hope helpful to people who are listening as to what is possible in their local JFCS, and I hope they take advantage of it. I know the agency here is just a superb agency, one of the leading agencies in the country, and sets the standard for many. So thank you. Thank you for your work. Continued good luck. I appreciate it very, very much, and appreciate very much being here with us. Thank you as well to all of you for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. This show and all others are archived on our homepage, on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. Again, let me invite your comments to me, Rabbi Address, at jewishsacredaging.com, or on the Jewish Sacred Aging podcast Facebook page. You can click on that or like it or whatever you do to that. And we encourage you to like the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page as well. And visit JewishSacredAging.com for articles, resources geared to baby boomers, our congregations, and our families. And we welcome your contributions to the website and the ongoing work of Jewish Sacred Aging. And a reminder that Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin at the studios of Lubetkin Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you very much for listening. See you next time on the next edition of Seekers of Meaning. Shalom.